here it is, showing how the relatively warm water that is around Antarctica can make its way onto the continental shelf, melt away the edge of the glacier, and cause it to flow faster into the sea. They've been able to show how this is happening quite rapidly, that it retreated at least 30 kilometers in the last 30 or 40 years. And quite crucially, as in the very bottom picture there, the fact that the bedrock under the ice is sloping inland means that this process continues, that as the glacier retreats, it leaves more space for the ocean to come in, melt away more ice, and cause it to flow even faster. And that is the process that I think people are most interested in and concerned about for the coming centuries, because this map of West Antarctica here shows, shaded in brown, the fact that the bed rock below the ice sheet is largely below sea level and slopes down to the deepest point in the middle of the ice sheet. So that once this process of melting the edge and increasing the flow increases, it might be impossible to stop. that's what glaciologists mean when they say that the West Antarctic ice sheet is vulnerable to collapse. Collapse is a dramatic word, and it has to be taken in context. Glaciologists, I guess, mean two things by it. One is that the rate at which it happens is much faster than the normal glaciological processes, so that part of the Antarctic ice sheet could disappear in a few hundred years, up to a couple of thousand years. That is several times faster than normal processes. And the other thing that they mean by collapse is that once it starts, it really would be impossible to stop, regardless of any changes in atmospheric CO2 or air temperature or emissions reductions. So the figures there are that collapse of the West Antarctic ice sheet would raise sea level by more than 3 meters at a much faster rate than sea level is presently rising. This is the cutting edge of understanding of ice sheet behavior, and it's not yet possible to include it in estimates of how sea level will rise in the coming century. All right, I'll stop there.
That's excellent. Thanks, Dan. I'll hand over now to Doug.
Okay, thanks. Thanks, Dan. Okay, Martin and Peter, Martin and Peter have covered some of the recent science around sea level rise and contributions and uncertainties associated with the major ice sheets. I'm now going to touch on what in a general sense, you know, what impacts implications this has for the New Zealand coastal margins and how we can account for this climate change and sea level rise and its associated uncertainties in making decisions around issues that are sensitive to climate and sea level rise influence and have long term implications. So the first thing is that sea level rise will exacerbate existing coastal hazards. It's not going to create any new hazards, but essentially the characteristics of past coastal hazards won't be a guide to what's going to happen in the future. So we're likely to see changing patterns and rates of coastal erosion in many places that will result in increased coastal erosion rates, but not everywhere. We're likely to see increases into the frequency, extent, magnitude of coastal inundation. And one thing that's often neglected, we may also see increases in drainage problems, substantial increases in drainage problems, both in terms of stormwater drainage in urban areas, but also drainage problems in areas that have been drained for agriculture. We'll also see landward intrusion of saltwater into estuaries and coastal aquifers, and that will change kind of ecology and water quality aspects. And these changes will be seen through changes in the magnitude and frequency of hazard events and the extent of their influence. But the future changes we're likely to see in coastal hazards and the changes to these coastal hazards are not just driven by sea level rise. In the coastal sense, there are complex interactions with a wide range of physical processes. For example, in estuaries, we're likely to see more intense rainfall events with climate change, changes in annual rainfall amounts, and that will influence the characteristics of flood events that influence the delivery of sediment to estuary systems. We'll also see sea level rise. It may well influence the change in volume that's entering and leaving these estuaries. We'll also potentially see changes in tide rain, saltwater incursion, temperature changes. And all these things will affect kind of sedimentation and the long-term morphological change of these estuaries, changes in the ecology, changes in the North Island, certainly in mangrove expansion. And it's not just sea level rise. It's a complex interaction of many different processes. On the open coast, it's the interaction of kind of wave climate, frequency and timing and magnitude of storm events along with sea level rise, and how all these processes interact and impact will determine how our coast changes in the future. So the past is not a good guide to what's going to happen in the future. We are going to see changes in the hazardscape or the characteristics that drive coastal hazards such as erosion and inundation. However, it's not just these hazards and these hazard drivers that are changing, that are causing increases to coastal hazard risk in our coastal margins. We're also seeing exposure to coastal hazards changing. So what's at risk from these coastal hazards? Now, if you look at 12 of the 15 largest towns and cities located around New Zealand that are on low-lying coastal and estuarine margins, and of course, as we're aware, over the last 60 years, there's been rapid development in many other coastal areas, you know, particularly along the Sandy Beach coastlines. And this picture just shows Pauanui in the Coromandel Peninsula. This picture was taken about 1940, the top picture, and how it looks today with a whole heap of development taking place there. And that's fairly common along much of the Coromandel Peninsula and many other places around New Zealand. And of course, there's pressure to continue to develop remains huge, even though we've had a bit of a downturn over the last couple of years due to the global economic situation. And also, the character of this development has also changed. We've moved from kind of simple batches that could be picked up and moved to multi-million-dollar properties that are much more permanent. So what else is at risk? Well, there was a New Zealand Transport Authority-funded study a couple of years ago that just looked in a general sense at what infrastructure was at risk around New Zealand, and they came up rather conservatively with some numbers there on rail, so about 160 kilometres of the national rail network, or 3.6% of it, 220 kilometres of state highway, 2,112 kilometres of local roads, and about 10 rail and road shared corridors. And, of course, other infrastructure like ports, marinas and things like that have to be located at the coastline. There's also significant areas of pastoral land that's at risk, you know, places like the Hauraki Plains, Canterbury Plains, and places like that have been drained in the past. And also things we value, things like scenery, natural landscape, ecosystems, recreational opportunities, and public access. And when we think about some of these things that we value about our coastline, it's perhaps not the threat of sea level rise and climate change per se that causes some of these biggest risks to these things of value, but rather perhaps how we respond to some of these effects of climate change that may pose a bigger risk. But we'll come back to that a little bit later. So in thinking about how we respond to some of these climate change and sea level rise related risks, as Martin and Dan have highlighted, we're already locked into some of these effects. Even if we reduce all greenhouse gas emissions tomorrow, we've seen about 16 or 17 centimetres rise in average sea level around New Zealand over the last century, and this will continue to rise for many centuries, even if we do reduce greenhouse gas emissions substantially tomorrow, which of course isn't going to happen. So adapting to these changes is vital. It's not just about mitigating greenhouse gas emissions, because these effects are underway. But when we think about adaption, it's not about doing something radically different. It's about adjusting the way we do things to accommodate climate change. And, of course, the earlier we take some of these actions, the more prepared we will be. And, reducing these impacts, these changes will have on New Zealand, both in terms of cost and damages. And perhaps importantly, it's ensuring that decisions we make today that have long-term lasting consequences, such as things like land planning and infrastructure development, don't lock us into options that make it harder for us to adapt in the future. So priorities for adaption effort need to be focused on decisions that really are sensitive to present-day climate extremes and variability. Preparing, to those type of events will provide both immediate and future benefits, but also have long-term, have long-lasting consequences. For example, subdivisions and infrastructure, as I've said. Land planning and infrastructure, are two sectors where really incorporating climate change and sea level rise considerations are vital. And in doing so, you know, it's about, because there's uncertainty about how much sea level rise will happen over the next 100 or 200 or so years, we have to take a precautionary approach to both new development and also changing to existing development. We need to ensure that new development doesn't increase risk levels, and we need to try and progressively reduce current risk levels to existing development. And that's could be relatively straightforward for new development in greenfield sites, but it's much more tricky for existing development where already development or infrastructure located in coastal margins that are at risk. So given some of the uncertainties in sea level rise, you know, what should we be planning for? Well, there's no one value. It really depends on what's at risk. And, you know, it depends whether we're thinking about siting a toilet block or a major piece of infrastructure, such as State Highway 16 in West Auckland. You know, the toilet block may only be there for 20 years. It may be relatively easy to pick it up and move it if erosion threatens it or if it gets flooded once too often. But moving essential infrastructure, such as kind of main roads, state highways and things like that, is much more difficult. It's essentially there's a permanency issue there. So risk management, you know, enables us to look at the range of future changes and their associated impacts and costs to be considered. You know, in doing this and looking at how much sea level rise you consider into any decision, it's about thinking about kind of the likelihood of particular sea level rise being reached over the particular time frame under consideration, but thinking about the associated consequences and how much it would cost to adapt to these consequences, and thinking about how residual risk would be managed. So it's not about just assuming a sea level rise of 50 centimetres or 80 centimetres or 1 metre. It's about thinking about kind of what the effect would be of a 50 centimetre rise in sea level rise would be, what the effect would be for 1 metre rise in sea level, what it might be for a 1.5 metre rise in sea level, what these consequences, what those costs might be, how much it may be to adapt to those costs. And also, once you've made that decision and you've assumed a level of sea level rise over your time frame of decision, if you undercook it, if it's higher than you've actually assumed, how would that residual risk be managed over the lifetime of that structure or infrastructure or that development? And I'm thinking about our communities at the coastline. I said one of the challenges earlier is really the risks to existing development, and that's really a very tough challenge for communities and authorities. And we're seeing in places already, Hamoana in Hawke's Bay, Mokau in the Waikato, you know, just how difficult it is to deal with some of these coastal hazard challenges. And it really needs to kind of begin to think, move away from this reactive and short-term approach to managing coastal hazards, where you have a storm event, erosion happens, and there's a demand for kind of seawall structures and trying to engineer our way out of trouble, to make it more proactively and strategically in the long term. And that's going to require some strong planning measures, some savvy council policy and implementation. But fundamentally, it really comes down to what do we value about our coastline, and what outcomes do we desire kind of for future generations. You know, do we want our coastlines to look like the top picture, or, I mean, this is perhaps overstating the mark a little bit, or something like this in this middle picture. And there's many examples of communities already taking things into their own hands, sort of coast care and dune care and activities like that around New Zealand, where communities are trying to restore the natural function of coastal defences and caring about what they value about their coastline. So in summing up, there's some significant challenges and opportunities represented by sea level rise and climate change on our coastal margins. Sea level rise has accelerated. I see contributions increasing. We don't know how much over the foreseeable future, the end of the century and beyond. But climate change effects on the coast is not just about sea level rise. It's a complex combination of storms, waves, erosions, and a whole range of other things, which makes understanding at any kind of particular location what the specific effects of climate change will actually be. Consideration of risk, considering kind of what's at risk, is a useful way to phrase kind of some of these issues and think about how to incorporate some of that uncertainty within decision making. But really, the challenge is going to be the kind of legacy of coastal development, and there's going to be some huge challenges in managing that effectively, kind of from kind of hold the line and engineering kind of approaches to responding to coastal hazards to something that's a bit more sustainable. So really, the real challenge and opportunity in many of these coastal communities is maintaining the coastal aspects that they value for future generations. And as Peter said earlier, there's been some information put out by the Ministry for the Environment a couple of years ago, a guidance manual and a short kind of publication document. Okay, thank you.
That's excellent. Thanks, Doug. What I'm going to do now, I'm just going to unmute everyone so we can open up for a bit of a Q&A session. I've already had one question submitted via the chat box from Kent Atkinson at NZPA, so I'll just quickly read that out, and Kent might want to add to it. Kent asks, to what extent will sea level rise due to melting ice vary in different parts of different oceans? For instance, if X amount of Greenland ice melts, what sea level rise is New Zealand likely to see compared with X amount of ice melting in Antarctica? Is there anyone particularly, Kent, you wanted to direct that to?
No, just whoever can suggest any comparative figures, because my understanding is that if, in fact, you may actually see sea levels fall close to Antarctica when Antarctic ice melts, because over a very long period, because the weight of the ice will actually allow the land to rise relative to the sea. But a lot further, much further away, say on the other side of the equator, you may see high levels of sea level rise compared with down in New Zealand from Antarctic ice melt.
Yeah, it's Dan here. I have the figure showing some of those effects in front of me, so I'm happy to address it. Yeah, you are correct in the process you mentioned. The one you mentioned about the rebounding of the land under an ice sheet change is actually quite a long-term effect that happens over the thousands of years after. So we don't think about that one too much in planning sea level change. Much more relevant for planning and estimating future sea level changes is a direct gravitational effect, that there is so much ice on Antarctica now that it actually increases the gravity field around there and pulls the ocean's water towards them. And if you melt some of the ice off Antarctica, then the water slops away as well, and so sea level goes down close to Antarctica and up in the rest of the world. And regarding the magnitude of those effects, globally it can be up to about 50% of the total effect, so that if you melt 1 meter off Antarctica or Greenland, you might get up to 1.4, 1.5 meters of sea level rise in some parts of the world. Now, for both melting off Greenland and Antarctica, New Zealand is reasonably neutrally placed, so that we don't see extreme high or extreme low differences. But there is a difference north-south across New Zealand, particularly if melting occurs from Antarctica. There's about a 10% difference between the sea level rise that you would see in Auckland and that in Christchurch.
So you would see more 10% higher sea level rise in Auckland than
more in Auckland than in Christchurch. That's right. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. All right.
Thanks, Dan.
And that's being taken into account in the preparations that local authorities, for instance, are making.
Yeah, if you're asking me, I'm not sure about that one, but it's one of these estimates where it's quite easy to calculate the physical effect, but that is completely dependent on what actually melts off Antarctica. So since we don't actually have any estimates of sea level change that have a particular timing for collapse of the Antarctic ice sheet, as far as I know, that effect isn't included in planning model.
Just to pin this down, would we see, if the same volume of ice melted in Antarctica and the same volume of ice melted in Greenland, would we see any difference in New Zealand because of the position where the ice was melting?
The main I think in both cases we would get about the same rise. If you melt a meter off of Greenland, we see also about a meter here. The main difference, as I said, is the change across New Zealand. So if it melts off Greenland, then it's roughly the same over the whole country.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thanks, Kent, and thanks, Dan. Any other questions there on the conference?
Hi, yeah, this is Gareth Renarden from Hot Topic here.
Yeah, hey, Gareth.
Question for Dan, and also I see we've got Peter Barrett online, so maybe he might like to chip in. The Royal Society paper mentions the last interglacial, the Eemian, as a possible model for where we're heading. And I just wondered if Dan and Peter might like to make some comments about the quantum of rise that occurred during the last interglacial and the sort of timescales and rates. One of the things that a number I came across recently, which was quite astonished me, was from the flooding of the North Sea at the end of the last ice age. And I have no source for this number beyond a TV presenter, but they were talking about the peak rates of inundation at the end of the last ice age, that parts of the bed of the North Sea were retreating at up to 100 metres, you know, the coastline was advancing at up to 100 metres a year. So I wondered to what extent we could use the Eemian as a model going forward.
Yeah, there is figure for the North Sea is interesting. Of course, the rate at which the coastline is advancing or retreating depends on the slope there. The North Sea is very flat and it doesn't take much of a rise to advance the coastline. The rate that sea level was actually rising globally was indeed very fast sometimes after the last ice age. Over short periods, over a few hundred years, a short period, up to 40 or 50 millimetres per year, that is 4 or 5 metres per century. So indeed much faster than we are experiencing now. But that was, the ice sheets at that time were quite different to the ice sheets we have now. It was, you know, that was mostly melting, it seems, off North America and Scandinavia. And the ice sheets now are in quite a different configuration. So as far as we can tell, those very fast rates aren't really applicable to our current situation. As you say, the Eemian, the last time the world was about as warm as it is now, is a much better analogy, because the ice sheets were about the same size as they are now, and temperatures were a little warmer than they are now. There are two things that the geological record can tell you. One is how much higher was sea level at that time, and the other is how fast might it have risen. The compilation of accepted published work by the IPCC in 2007 suggested that sea level at that time was 4 to 6 metres higher. And there's plenty of evidence for that around the world. A more recent, very comprehensive study, which approached, used the geophysical models of how ice and earth and gravity all change together, and as much sea level data as they could find from this time period, suggest a much higher value. And they did it statistically, very, very much as stated as probabilities. But they say a 95% chance that it was more than 6 metres higher, or more than 6.5 metres higher, and still 67%, so still likely chance that it was more than 8 metres higher than present. The reconstructions of both West Antarctica, as I showed, with the likelihood or the possibility of collapsing the whole of that area that's below sea level, and the similar sort of study for Greenland, both make that number of 8 metres certainly plausible to reach from our current ice sheet configuration. As far as rates go, from the geological studies, it's impossible to give rates of sea level rise on a century scale. You just don't have fine enough information. So looking at rates of sea level rise over a millennium time scale, I think that recent study suggested up to 15 metres per millennium. And you can draw it back to a century, but they don't think that's particularly applicable.
Thanks for that, Dan. I think we'll just move to a question from another question from Kent. This is for Doug, and Kent's asking about those 12 cities you mentioned, Doug, that are most at risk from rising sea levels. Have they been ranked at all in terms of the potential risk? Ken asked, for instance, is Tauranga, Mount Maunganui at greater risk than, say, Auckland?
I'm certainly not aware of any attempt to look at the relative risk for each of the coastal cities around each of the coastal cities and towns around New Zealand. I mean, certainly some regional councils and district territorial authorities have been doing, you know, inundation assessments, assessments of potential impacts of climate change on inundation and erosion, but they've all adopted slightly different methodologies or adopted slightly different timeframes. So I'm not aware of any study that's attempted to look at the relative risk of each of those 12 locations.
Can I just follow up with a question on that? You mentioned different territorial authorities and regional councils using different methodologies. I'm wondering whether there is likely to be any scope for a national approach, almost a national standard in the way that coastal issues are handled, so that there's a consistent approach across the country, and the potential for a coherent, linked response with things like, for instance, storm surges could be predicted very precisely, I suspect, by something like NIWA with its ties to regional councils and territorial councils, and you would then have a more consistent response along the piece of coast that's all going to be hit by the same forces of nature.
Certainly, there's a number of things that are currently happening that will help provide a bit more consistency and information. First of all, there's a sister manual that's being produced, a sister manual to the Coastal Hazards and Climate Change Guidance Manual, was produced a couple of years ago, and that's really more a technical how-to manual to define coastal hazard zones and coastal hazard. Focusing on coastal erosion and coastal inundation. Now that's still a guidance manual. It won't be, you know, a national policy. On the storm surge and wave climate issue, there's work. There's a 3-year research project that's going on just now that involves NIWA, and that's looking at how storm surge and wave climate will change under one particular emission scenario. So we're looking at the wave climate and storm surge climate around New Zealand for the last 30 years or from 1970 to 2000, calibrating a global climate model to that information, and then seeing how that will change by 2070 to 2100. So that the results from that should be out about this time next year or about September time next year, and that will give us a much better handle on how storm surge and wave climate will be changing around our coastline. And Dan mentioned some work that's been going on a comparable kind of science project that's looking at how kind of sea levels will vary around the coastline. So about this time next year, we should be in a better place to understand how some of those drivers of coastal hazards may change towards the end of the century.
But if we have some councils planning on the basis of the existing IPCC, say preparing for 60 centimetres of rise, and others looking ahead to a potential of up to 1.9 metres of rise, is there a risk that those bureaucratic approaches may be overtaken by, say, the insurance industry simply refusing to insure properties they see at risk on coastal land?
It's possible, but I mean, it's, you know, this is an issue we faced when we were writing the Coastal Hazards and Climate Change Guidance. It's very difficult to be very prescriptive in terms of saying, you know, you will use this sea level rise and rise value. And again, what I was trying to say in the presentation, it really comes down to what's at risk and making a sensible decision based on, you know, based on what's at risk from your decision. So if it's major subdivisions, infrastructure, then you're obviously wanting to be kind of, you know, approaching some of these higher levels, sea level. If it's something that has less kind of impact or less impact, then you may be able to accommodate kind of lower levels of sea level. So it's very difficult to kind of give one number.
But we see in countries like Britain, authorities actually actively preparing to abandon coastal land to stop maintaining dikes and levees and so on, and just turn the land over to the sea, and they're actively working to set that in place now. I don't see any of that happening in New Zealand.
No, but certainly, I mean, the pressures in New Zealand are much less than they are in the UK, where, I mean, the UK coastal defence budget is somewhere approaching a billion pounds mm-hmm. pounds a year. You know, so they're, you know, and actually kind of, you know, trying to maintain that line in the UK is a much more costly exercise than it is in New Zealand. But these are certainly some of the issues that some regional councils and some communities are now facing, and there may well be places that will not be feasible to protect, and we may have to think about retreating from the coastline. And yes, I don't think we have had enough discussion on looking at some of these other options.
This is Martin Manning here. I just comment that I've been called into two environmental court hearings within the last 6 months, and in both cases, I would say the environmental court judges are trying to keep up with latest science very carefully, and so they do understand the need for a sort of risk management type of planning. And one of the findings of one of those environmental courts was very explicit about it depends on what you're planning. If you're planning a major investment, then yes, you should be looking at something like 1.5 meter sea level rise by the end of the century. If you're just putting up a batch or something like that, then you can look at the bottom end of the range. So I think there's starting to become a recognition of a planning process for dealing with this. But it needs, I think the questions are very good because it does need to become more coherent across the whole country.
Yeah, agreed.
Thank you.
Thanks for that. Any final questions there?